Hi there. Welcome to another episode of the Customer-Led Groove Show, where we discuss and share the best practices and the latest trends in customer marketing, advocacy, and customer-led growth. Today's episode is brought to you by BASE, a pioneer in B2B marketing and the industry's first CLG ecosystem for customer-led marketers, sales, and product professionals. Okay, let's welcome the CLG team and today's guests.
Hi there. Welcome to another episode of Customer-Led Groove. Today, we're at the newly launched CLG campus with Allison Hartso. Allison is the author of The Age of Customer Equity. She's a serial entrepreneur, an analytics guru. She's worked with Nike, HP, Intel, Microsoft. The list goes on. And she's also published in the MIT Technology Review, Forbes, and more. And her book is I highly recommend her book. But before we start digging into that, welcome, Allison.
Thank you, Scott. It's such a pleasure to be here at Customer-Led Groove. It's such a great title, and I'm looking forward to having a lot of fun.
You're the first person we're talking to after launching the CLG campus. And Allison also has a course in the CLG campus. Lots of questions to ask you. Very inspired by your book. But before we do, maybe you can tell us a little bit about your journey.
You know, my journey into analytics is like a lot of people of this generation where we didn't necessarily start out in analytics. I actually started out in journalism because it was the only avenue that allowed me to get all of my curiosity answered. And what I picked up from the journalistic space was the need for a more quantitative approach to a number of topics that quickly led to startups in Silicon Valley, startups that dealt with syndication, startups that dealt with eBay, startups that dealt with just the mechanics of how do you generate business online. But what was so exciting in the online world is you could suddenly take all of these bits and pieces that you hadn't been able to quantify before and move them into a way that people could make decisions. And that's what I always love when I think about my career. There's all these different avenues, all these different places, but what it's really been about is taking information, digesting it into something that is signal and actionable signal. And that's what I really like to do.
Nice. And then today, what are you doing? I mean, I know you got your own company, you got your own book, but like, just double click on that for a second.
Yeah. Today I'm in a contest with a friend to read as many books as possible over the course of 1 year. So send me your book recommendations. I'm learning a lot very quickly. But when I'm working, I'm still putting out a lot of what should we be doing with our strategy? Here's where our company is. How do we move forward given a certain goal? So maybe the goal has to do with, I want to generate more sales, or the goal is I want to get closer to our customers. I want to understand the segments. I make a lot of recommendations about how to use data to achieve a very specific outcome in such a way that the rest of the organization comes along with you.
That's great. I hate doing this, but telling the audience to think about this as Allison talks, think about how this can apply to your organization and how to get started with data and where your organization is today. And I'm sure we're going to get to like, how do you move in the direction to be more, not just customer driven, but data driven as well. And with that, so you call your book Customer Equity. Just tell me a little bit about why you picked the word equity.
Yeah, the age of customer equity reflects the specific space we are in now, where there's been a change. Customers are more empowered than ever before, mostly as a result of social data and mobile data, but also as a result of transparency. You might remember back in the day when you had your desktop and you didn't have a mobile phone, God forbid, you had to go to a store, figure out what the price was, maybe go to a second store. It's a big lift, right? But now we have a lot of transparency across data, and that gives customers a lot of power. And so the book is reflecting the idea that customers are more empowered than ever before, And as a result, you can't just build a brand and expect people to show up because you're the only store in town. You have to think more about the people who are your buyers and what they need from you.
You talk about customer centricity, and you do a good job in the book talking about being product-led versus customer-led. Maybe you can talk a little bit about that.
So when a corporation goes to apply the idea of equity, what they're really doing is saying, of all the people that have purchased from us in the past and then projecting forward into the future, what is the value of the customer base? The reason we look at that and the reason we think about equity in particular is companies think in terms of dollars. And if you want to get their attention, you really need to talk in terms of dollars. And so when we think about customers from a potential dollar point of view, it allows us to make really good decisions as a company, but it also creates crossover where the customers that get the attention of the company are then opened up a little bit more. What is it that this person really needs to make a purchase? What is it that allows this particular group of customers to understand that you are the best fit for them? Why do they buy from you? And so this narrowing, this use of customer equity through customer lifetime value as the North Star allows us to narrow where the specific actions should be within a company. Now, you asked about product-centric versus customer-centric. So in a customer-centric point of view, you are saying, who is my most valuable customer? What do they need next? And what kind of loyalty and retention am I seeing from that customer base? How can I help them more? And have my products as a secondary feature help the customer. In a product-centric point of view, it's flipped. So now I'm thinking about, I've got a lot of widgets and I need to get my widgets out the door. Otherwise, I'm going to take a hit on the balance sheet because I've got too many widgets in inventory. How do I push more widgets out the door through the customer funnel and get them to buy it at either price A or price B or channel A or channel B? Can you hear the difference in the thinking?
Yeah, that's really key. Now, I like that in the product versus outside the product, because there's so much more that happens outside of the product as well. And so we have to kind of remember that.
Yeah.
You talk about the most valuable or high value customers. How are you thinking about, like in my world, I'm always thinking about the rising stars. The all stars are the top tier. And I think companies often forget the rising stars, and they can get to them through modeling, which you talk about. But there's also just like looking at those trends, whether it's in, we have the campus, for example. So if I see like people are taking XYZ course, they might have the potential to be a rising star later on, so to speak.
Exactly. And I love that you've mentioned that, because what some people do is they say, okay, I'll sort my customers into high, medium, or low value customers. And then I'll just hammer on the high value customers because they're going to give me more money. That's the wrong way to think about it. What you really are looking for is in that middle space, the people whose spark line is, you know, maybe it's trending down a little bit and you can pop it up a little bit. That's the place where business is generally improved more easily. That doesn't mean that you ignore your high value customers any more than you ignore your low value customers, but there's a markedly different strategy that gets applied to the different customer sets. And you can further segment from that framework. But just on the surface, the way I like to think about it is high value customers can really benefit from an emotional relationship. What is it that you can give them that is a step beyond a transaction? So Coffee Bean and Tea Leaf did something really interesting. They knew they had this set of high value customers, and they reached out to offer them a tour of their office. They knew they had this group of people who really loved the brand, really wanted to come and get closer to it. And you wouldn't normally think that would be exciting, but it was to that group of people, something they didn't have access to otherwise. A second group in the middle is the one, these are the people who maybe you are thinking about in a transactive way, and you want to get them to not just consider your company with everybody else. You want them to move from consider you and all your competitors to considering you first or in a more loyal fashion. And so reaching that group has a little bit more to do with transactional cadence, What's the right buy cycle for them? And how do you encourage them to continue to think about your brand? That's different from the low value customer base, which is often a group that comes in on $19.99, buy this $75 shirt for $19.99. That's a dangerous group. And sometimes it is relevant that you have a one and done buyer and they haven't bought from you again in many years, and they probably will never buy from you again. That doesn't mean that their value is zero. It just means that there's probably something outside your control that is causing that person's economic situation or their social situation to be such that they might not buy from you again. So I had a kid that was younger. Maybe I bought some kind of preschool toy. Now my kid is older. I don't buy that anymore. Would be an example of a low value customer that you simply can't rescue. There are low value customers you shouldn't ignore that you can bring back up. It just depends on what's in that customer base, but the rule there is to be cost effective.
Yeah, back at almost the turn of the century, I worked at American Express and worked on the retention side and some of their programs. And we used to take our whole universe of contacts and break them out into deciles and score them based on activity of not just interacting with the product, a credit card or multiple credit cards, but also different channels. And then you would decide, like, you know, how deep you would go in terms of email or in other communications based on, you know, the value of those audiences, you know, decile 1 to 10, or the costs. I would love to see the B2B marketing space get there at some point, but I know we're earlier in our journey compared to the B2C world.
Why 10? Why deciles? And, you know, when I think about that, yeah, it's convenient to break things into 10, but is it really applicable, or should you maybe be looking at a curve and then thinking about what's the logical breakpoint in that curve? Mm-hmm. I like that approach a lot better than the traditional deciles because you can see the movement a lot better.
Say more about the curve. So what would be, just if you can describe it a little bit more.
So the way I like to break it out is CLV projected forward. So we're not talking about how much money did you spend with me? We're talking about what is the future propensity of how much you will spend with me. So if I bought something for $100, then what you are likely to spend with me in the future is some factor of $100 that's based on future lifetime value of money, how often you purchased, but it usually degrades over time, right? Mm-hmm. So there's some portion of that. And it's just a statistical guess that's put into dollar terms. But if I take that and I map that across the customer base, then I end up with a curve of where people fall, and I can kind of break it into financial terms as opposed to bucket A, bucket B, bucket C, which I find very hard to relate to, because when was the last time somebody called you a decile? It's not a fair human term.
I've been called lots of things, not a decile.
I'd rather be referred to as a growing customer or a shooting star customer or any number of descriptors that are more human than decile.
No, that's a really, really great point. Okay. So a lot of us, meaning people who are listening in, are in customer facing roles, and you've developed something called the customer centric maturity model. And you talk a little bit about the transformation that companies go through. Maybe you can take us through that a little bit.
It goes through three stages. The first stage is listening to your customers. The second stage is learning from your customers. And the final stage is leading your customers. And the first stage, listen, is really signatured by how much does an organization pull in data that they can tier their customer base, but also trust that data enough that they will take action on it. At least it's some low risk version. And that's usually very deep within the company, within some department, is somebody taking action on the data. As you move up in the model to the learning stage, you actually move up a level in the organization. And now I'm blending more data together. I'm using experimentation to try to understand, well, would choice A be better than choice B? And what can I figure out from the data based on the reaction to those choices that I put out? And that's where you're really putting out your hypotheses and you're learning from your customer base. And you can see why it's really important that you've trusted that data in the first place in the listen stage. You've collected it, you've trusted it. Now you're experimenting and you're building on it. But then when you get to the lead stage, that's where it gets really exciting. That's where you have algorithmic leadership. That's what feeds your machine learning models. Now I'm not just running a handful of experiments. I'm running thousands of experiments and really trying to figure out how to separate my company from the pack when it comes to being of service to my customer base. And that's a lot of at a high level of the company, because you've got to bring in the technology and the different departments, not just marketing, but supply chain all across the board. So each stage you're moving up within the organization.
So I would guess that most of folks listening in are in the listening, maybe leaning into the learning a little bit. Again, I think B2C and B2B, this is like one of the big differentiators, at least from my experience, is that the B2C companies that I've interacted with have just been very sophisticated on the data side. But if I'm in the listening stage, like what are some tactics I can use to get to the learning stage?
I generally find that there's a couple things that help in that stage. One is to humanize the data. I like to humanize it by shaping it into use cases. And this means that, let's say I have an e-commerce site and people come through, but I don't really know you. I haven't signatured you. Maybe I don't have comprehensive data that you are an individual person. But what I can do is I can shape all of that traffic flow into people who are trying to do X. And by thinking about any data stream in terms of this cluster of people who are trying to get something solved, that allows you to step away from the distancing language or the arcaneness of page views or impressions or, you know, time on call, and really get to people and how do you solve for them. And I find that that brings people on board a little more, because everybody feels good when you've solved a problem for a set of people. Mm-hmm. But nobody really cares when your page views have moved from A to B, right? That's like, okay, I came home and I told my kids about that, but no one understood what I was talking about, right? So it's not as motivating. So changing the language we use can be a very helpful way to humanize the data, get more people interested in it, and not expect everyone to become an analyst in order to understand what's going on in the data. So I like that one a lot.
Yeah, no, I like that part about the using the language and being really mindful in the language you use. So a lot of folks probably don't have a data scientist on their team and, you know, don't have that resource. Is there any advice you can give them if they don't? Like when I was at Udacity, I had this incredible data team. When I was at HubSpot, which does have data scientists, but I didn't have them available for me. They were focused on other things. What do you recommend for companies that are in that situation?
You know, I always think campaign tagging is like the underutilized, easiest thing you can do to really augment the data and understand people. So typically when you launch a campaign, you put some tags on it, but the tags are related to what the campaign name, what channels did it run? What was the purpose of the campaign? You know, it was to give you 20% off to come and buy a particular, you know, Black Friday deal. But if you augment that with the type of audience that you're after, you know, we're really targeting new buyers that we haven't seen before who seem to be an adjacent field. So this is more of a test with our group. And you start feeding that into the campaign codes. It's just a query string, meaning it's a question mark. And it's an element that you can stick in behind the link click. And then your analyst can see it, or anyone who's not even an analyst can pull it up and see it. And you can use that to separate your data into more human categories. So I like the query string parameters in campaign codes for an easy way to start to look at different customers and how they react to the messages you're putting out.
Yeah, it's funny. One of the nerdy things I do is look at UTM codes and see what's there. Yeah. And I don't think very often there's like that human segment or people segment or market segment. Like it's for Facebook, it's campaign July 2020, whatever it is.
But you know, one of the things that you raise that's really important is because not that many people are using it, it's also a public viewable item. So consider whether you want to use some kind of alphanumeric string that you unlock in a spreadsheet that says, okay, it was really this audience. In a competitive space, I would absolutely do that. I'd be very careful.
Somebody asked this question today in one of the Slack channels. It's not exactly this. It's somewhat related here. So we talked about not having data scientists. It was around the tool set, and they couldn't afford to buy, you know, our product or a, you know, one of our competitors' products. So they were asking, like, how do we set up these campaigns or how do we track these things? And I defaulted to Google Sheets. I also, in the old days, meaning 2 years ago, I used QuickBase. Any other suggestions around that?
You know, I think the easiest thing to do is a shared spreadsheet, maybe Airtable. That's a really nice one where you can put the triggers in. So now I don't have to know how to code. I can set a framework that makes certain things consistent in the sheet because I don't want to have one capitalized, one not capitalized, email spelled with a dash, email without the dash. I don't want to create these splits in the data. So I want to make it consistent, but I also don't want to be the choke point for every campaign that's going out, right? I don't want to have to do that as part of my job. So I would look at Airtable as a really easy way to generate campaign codes and then integrate with a trigger that does the work for you.
I can't believe I forgot Airtable. Yeah, no, that's great. Great product. Anything else around this model, customer-centric maturity model that you can give advice to folks about how to like get started with it? I think one of the things is we tend to develop these models and they kind of sit in this virtual closet for a while. So I know, you know, looking at it weekly, but is there any other kind of tips you have for folks?
Well, the reason why I really like projecting CLV is because it allows you to ask for a raise more easily. Let me explain that. Let's say you pay me $100,000 to work in your marketing department. And let's say that I run a CLV analysis. I take the customer base that I have, and I can even just do this one time. And I project forward and I'm like, wow, there's $8 million in our customer base. I can make a pretty good argument by understanding how much that base changes. If I run that CLV analysis on January 1st, year one, and then I run it again, either 6 months later or maybe another year later, that number will change. Hopefully, if I've done a good job in marketing, that number gets bigger. But let's say it gets bigger because I'm projecting into the future. Let's say it gets bigger by $2 million. So now the value of the customer base has moved from 8 million to 10 million. But you're still paying me $100,000. And there's 2 million that I brought to you. So now the conversation for how to get a raise or how to get more budget has a high anchor point that you can say, you know, here's where I've actually moved the needle for you. And here's what you're paying me. So why don't you pay me some percentage of that? And, you know, maybe double my salary because I can move this group further. Now, maybe that's not just about your salary. Maybe that's your team or your budget, or maybe that's a program that you want to take a chance on. But when you project the value of the customer base forward, you end up with a number that allows you to have a good discussion internally of how much it's worth to take action A or action B, whatever that action is.
Yeah, no, that's great. You know, one question I didn't ask earlier is when you think about your work and customer-centric approach and your model, how can people apply that to their advocacy programs? We talked about the top value, high value, you know, customers, but a lot of folks here have their own advocacy programs. And I think that you could offer kind of a new way of looking at that.
When you say advocacy program, are you talking about loyalty program or are you talking about advocacy in terms of the Edelman model of moving through the customer journey?
Think of it more like a loyalty program, but you really are identifying these people are your customers or your business partners and, you know, what's in it for them? How are you going to help them with their craft, their career, et cetera? But also, you know, longer term, you want them to advocate on your behalf. You want them to, you know, provide customer stories.
Fans.
Yeah. Fans.
I mean, advocacy is when you've reached the highest level. You've got the love of the customer operating for you. And that generates word of mouth. And that is just marketing you cannot buy. It's so valuable. So I think about loyalty programs in terms of the transactional loyalty, which is, hey, you bought Chipotle yesterday and you didn't buy it this week. Now I want you to buy Chipotle again. As opposed to the more heartfelt, emotional loyalty programs that I think Starbucks does pretty well. They're good at just getting your transactional loyalty in, but then thinking about, hey, you like coffee, but maybe you also like coffee house music, or maybe there's a special thing that we can push in at this top level that makes you really love our brand. That's tricky. But it's worth experimenting and it's worth going after in order to get to advocacy. So the fact that you've got baristas who are just like, oh my God, please don't ask for a unicorn, like a unicorn something or other, which is like the most difficult drink ever to make, is a high sign of advocacy. It's a sign of this loyal base that just loves to come up with all these amazing coffee drinks, right? That's awesome. Just have to figure out how to make it easier on your team.
Yep.
That's a great way to take a product-centric strategy, turn it into a customer-centric strategy, hammer it home with some emotional advocacy and loyalty on top of it. Now, Starbucks has a privilege in that they have an addictive product that people come back for again and again. So that gives them a lot of learning data. But what if you are selling automobiles and you don't necessarily get a purchase every day from the same person?
Yep.
Then you can still do a lot around loyalty and trust. I see great owners programs. Tesla does a great job with this, the way they have owners sell other owners on their gatherings. That's another example of emotional advocacy and loyalty.
Awesome. Just a few more questions. Is there any question I haven't asked you today that you thought about when we were discussing your book and everything else? Usually what I say is, damn, Wilder, why didn't you ask me that?
I really like the questions you asked, Scott. I think the maybe one question about what holds companies back is pretty relevant.
Yeah.
I see a lot of people who are folks that are very powerful analysts, very powerful thinkers in the field, get stymied in certain organizations. And I think as a person who might be at the director level or below, you might have to leave an organization to move on to one that gets it, that moves forward, because some organizations just can't be turned from the bottom of the org chart. And no matter how often you present really great ideas, it just doesn't go anywhere. And again, I've seen some amazingly talented people present spot on ideas, but get nowhere. But when they change to more modern organization, they made a little more progress. And then sometimes they changed again and they made even more progress. So I wouldn't hesitate to move around, because if you think about the competitive nature of data, it's moving faster and faster. And organizations that are not getting it are separating from the pack of leaders who are. So if you care about your career and you care about your company, you either get on board and get the data running, or you get with a company who is.
You know, when I was at Udacity, the head of our data analytics group, data science group, reported directly to the CEO, which I thought was incredible.
That is.
Have you seen any other organizations or any organization models that you think really work in terms of being more customer-centric?
Yeah, I've seen a bunch, actually. One company that really impressed me during COVID was Chipotle. They got their systems dialed in. They got their loyalty programs and their apps and all their touchless contact information completely dialed in. And so from marketing all the way through to the delivery of the product, they were on it. Like they knew who you were. They wanted you to come back. They didn't come after you again and again and again, like on a strict cadence, but they would use a certain odd cadence to say, hey, we haven't seen you in a while. Hey, it's a special day. and keep reactivating your interest in them. But what was so interesting was an analyst comment. I think it was a Piper Jaffray analyst comment on one of the Wall Street calls. And what she noticed was that Chipotle's technology infrastructure could basically be lifted up and applied to another quick service brand and another quick service brand. And that is the benefit of getting the data dialed in, is all of a sudden you set up this algorithmic leadership and you know how to make it happen. You just kind of pick up another industry or another avenue of your existing product set. And I haven't seen Chipotle do that yet, but I think that potential is really amazing. Could Starbucks do that? I bet they could. And I think we'll start seeing more and more of that with the companies that get their data dialed in.
Nice. No, I love that. That's great. So another question I like to ask folks here is, who or what, meaning like a book or a website, who's influenced you the most in terms of your professional career?
Without a doubt, Gary Angel has been an incredible influence. He and I talk an awful lot. And if you haven't read his book, definitely have to read his book, Measuring the Digital World. But his concepts are still straight up dialed in. So he's been a huge influence. And he's currently taking those concepts into the IoT space, which I think is incredible. I also think if you're looking toward the future, one of the books I read recently that I thought was incredibly powerful, Max Tegmark, Life 3.0, Being Human in the Age of Artificial Intelligence.
Life 3.
He does a really good job of thinking forward maybe 20-ish years and saying, what happens when you have algorithmic leadership and you take AI and you bring it in? Then what? There are some really interesting ethical considerations that we should be addressing today. What if someone has a health issue? What is protected PII data? When do you make sure that the people in your customer base are actually still alive and you're not marketing to someone who's dead? I mean, there's all sorts of ethical gotchas that we can flex our muscles on now while we are learning how to do the bigger questions of AI later.
No, that's great. Yeah, it's funny. Like my mother passed away a few years ago and I still keep an eye on her accounts, her email accounts and all that. And I'm just amazed of, because I've even written some of these companies saying, take me off your list or anyway. And you mentioned Gary. So Gary, just a confession here. He is one of my mentors too. And I think for anybody that's interested in the analytics space is you should Google him and look at what he's done. And he's definitely focusing more on the bricks and mortar world or retail world. But if you go back, when he had his company Symphonic, which he sold to EY, there's a lot of great learnings there. One of them for me, which really influenced me was his functional approach. And what that was basically is when I was, at Intuit and Marketo, everybody was kind of wrestling with path analysis and just like, it's really hard to look at path analysis. And it sounds simple, but no one was talking about it at the time of just pick a few point A to point B or point A to C and point D. Like, what do you think? And then, look at the numbers there and look, at the behaviors of what's happening within those. And so again, I should put his article Functional Analysis on the campus because it's an oldie, but a goodie, as they say.
It is. And if you really want to understand how to do use cases, Gary's book is the reference for it.
Anything else? I mean, we've covered so much. This is great. I'm going to have to get you back on the show.
Oh, it's been so much fun, Scott. I can always talk about this subject. There's so much goodness companies can do if they just understand the data in the right lens and put a little thought behind it. I think there's a lot of distance we can cover together.
Yeah. And I like you're taking data and really humanizing the customer through that. And that's something I really like. Okay. Well, Allison, thank you for joining us today. I'm going to wind down here. So thank you all for joining us at Customer Led Groove. My name is Scott. We've been with Allison. Check us out on the CLG campus, which just launched. I look forward to hearing you and seeing you on the next episode. Thank you.
Thank you again for joining Customer Led Groove. Remember, you can find us on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, and on the CLG campus. Feel free to rate us, follow us, and leave a comment on any of those platforms. We hope to see you again soon when we're back in the Customer-Led Groove.